Hello and welcome to LedgerCast. My name is Brian Krogsgaard. Today I have a special guest, the head of business development at Bitstamp, and a trader that I've been getting to know over the past year or so. I've got Miha Gercher with me. Hey, Miha.
Hey.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, we've gotten to know each other a little bit over the past year. You are a veteran of the crypto space, but you also trade many traditional markets, particularly futures markets. We're going to cover a little bit of all of that, but I'd like folks to get your backstory. Since you've been in crypto for a long time, was your original trading story in crypto, or were you in other markets first?
Well, actually, I got into trading because of Bitcoin and crypto. I was kind of fortunate enough to get into Bitcoin relatively early on, so early 2012. And 2013, I started my career at Bitstamp. And of course, as a newcomer, I would look at the charts and I could not make any sense of it. It was, you know, something completely different since I came from a different background. So in order to understand what the hell I'm actually doing, I started kind of studying what trading is all about, put on a trade, lose some money, put on another trade, lose some more money, and then discover Forex and lose a ton of money. But, you know, you improve over time.
Yeah. So when you were trying to learn, I mean, were you even thinking of Bitcoin as something that you do technical analysis for at the time, or was it more of a fundamental viewpoint in terms of why you were thinking about it?
I would say that when it comes to Bitcoin, I probably have a very fundamental view on what it's worth. But in terms of my trading, I'm a technical trader. I don't do fundamentals. I'm too lazy. Often I can't even understand what the fundamental means.
Yeah. So you got to Bitstamp in 2013. The history of Bitstamp on TradingView goes back to August 2011. So you were there within the first couple of years of it being an exchange. How much has the exchange space changed over time from your point of view?
Well, it changed a lot. When I joined, I would say it was more a hobby than a real business. So today an exchange is a pretty sophisticated organization, you know, in terms of operations, security, infrastructure, procedures. And also if you look at how the markets behave, it's becoming more and more efficient. And sure, when you talk with people from the traditional space, they always come up with the same thing of it's a very nascent market or it's very immature. Well, compared to when I started, looking back on it, I mean, if today is immature, that was just like, you know, Mickey Mouse. That was not even something that you could compare to a regular market.
Yeah. And when you were involved initially, I know now you're the head of business development. What was your initial role coming in and what experience, I guess, brought you to Bitstamp in the first place?
When I started, there wasn't really this career kind of attitude to it. 2012 to 2013, not many professionals were into Bitcoin at the time. So I was fortunate to know one of the co-founders of Bitstamp since my late teens, and he told me about Bitcoins, I think as early as 2010, and yeah. I didn't even invest at the time. But as time progressed, I kind of finished my university. I was just entering the employment market, which at the time, you know, 2012 in Europe is more rough. Like the unemployment market.
Yeah.
And I was looking for things to do to, you know, pay the rent and earn something for a living. And one day I just got a text from Damien saying, would you work for Bitstamp? And I joined in a heartbeat and I was employee number 3. So, and today we're something like 200 people across the globe. So I would say it's been a long road.
Yeah, that's awesome. I often think I entered the workforce in 2008. I was graduating basically into the start of the financial crisis. And I think that time really helped spawn a lot of entrepreneurs because, you know, like the traditional businesses were pretty much all on big hiring freezes. So people either went their own way or into small businesses, or they, like in my case, I was basically the last person in the door before they stopped hiring where I was working. And I feel like it really set kind of a mental framework for people over those few years in terms of what it looks like to have a job. Have you experienced, did you feel the same way?
Yeah, I agree. It was a lot of that entrepreneurial spirit. And also, you asked me about roles. They weren't really defined roles when I joined. Sure, we had a CEO, the CTO, and if you joined as employee number three, you were pretty much doing everything. So over my time at Bitstamp, I was wearing many hats. I was running operations for something like 2 or 3 years, which means that I went from customer support to onboarding, KYC, compliance, you know, everything that kind of makes the exchange tick on a day-to-day basis. And then I kind of moved into business development, since I think not many people out there have such mileage when it comes to experience in the crypto space, at least.
What does that consist of in terms, what does business development look like in the crypto space and particularly in the exchange space?
For me, it was always very heavy around banking relationships. So cryptocurrency exchange such as Bitstamp is, sure, it's a place where price discovery happens, but at the same time, it's also an on and off ramp between the two worlds. And without solid banking, you don't really have a business nor an operation.
Yeah, y'all have gone, I think, you've stayed a little more true, I guess, is maybe a better way to phrase it, than a lot of other exchanges, because you aren't using any stable coins. It's a strictly banking and, fiat gateway currency or gateway exchange. And you have a very limited selection of currencies that you have on the platform. Is it 5 that you have on there?
Yeah, we have 5. So the major ones, it's not something which we would just say that we're going to stay with 5. But we were always very cautious and careful about what we list, especially because throughout time, you see many projects and shitcoins come and go. And we built our brand around stability and predictability, security, and listing and delisting stuff that may be a Ponzi scheme or a fraud is just not something what we consider to be a good business practice. And that's one of the reasons why for a very long time, we just focused on Bitcoin. I wouldn't necessarily say that we're, you know, maximalist, but you do need to look at resilience and stability when it comes to these protocols.
Yeah, and it seems to have served you well. I mean, I don't know how many exchanges there were 2012 and 2013 and, you know, until now that came and went. Oftentimes due to maybe moving too fast or getting into things they shouldn't have gotten into, but y'all have really stood the test of time. And now, you seem to be, you know, one of the real go-to places in terms of where people are going to recommend folks to go through, especially if they're entering with fiat. And that's led you to be part of many indexes as well, whether it's, you know, CME or other exchanges that are using you as kind of their baseline price. That leads me into a couple of questions. One is, I guess there's this crazy story from, well, maybe it's not that crazy, but the most recent example of where people were broadly speculating that there was some manipulation going on in the market where Bitcoin had something like $1,000 down candle due to a market order on Bitstamp. And because of your role as a market exchange for BitMEX and CME, there was speculation that someone was trying to manipulate the price on Bitstamp in order to affect the price on derivatives exchanges. Is that something that y'all look at and take seriously, do review of? I'm sure you're in that process. How do y'all approach a situation like that where those types of accusations in the air?
So you're correct in saying that market manipulation is a very heavy word and also something which we take very seriously. Mm-hmm. We're currently still investigating and looking into it, but I can't really share anything at the moment. But I can say this, that situations like that can be can happen due to many different factors.
Yeah.
And you basically just have to go through a list and exclude them one by one to actually figure out what happened.
Yeah, and I know y'all had a lot of logic in place in order to, you know, prevent things to overwhelm the exchange. And I'm curious how y'all worked on your technology stack over the years, because I'm sure that that's been a journey. If it was, you know, something that you started basically as a hobby in early days and it's become more and more sophisticated, how have y'all managed to iterate and turn it into an exchange with the type of technology that I guess more institutional players or advanced traders are accustomed to in traditional markets?
We always try to balance the investment into technologies and what we actually needed. So this institutional play that a lot of people are referencing to lately is something that comes at a considerable price. So if you remember 2017, everyone was like, institutions are coming, as if yeah. every single investment bank is just going to plug into, you know, the WebSocket and REST API and just like start firing away.
It wait doesn't for your work orders. That way.
Yeah, exactly. And all the retail is going to be rich and the bankers will lose. And, you know, that kind of mentality. Looking at how our technology evolved, it started with two laptops and one used server in the garage. Literally, you know, that kind of classic startup story. Today, we have a lot of different things that, you know, we have to maintain. And you've mentioned technology and security go hand in hand when it comes to operating a Bitcoin exchange. So, for example, in terms of connectivity technology, we are migrating to an off-the-shelf matching engine solution simply because we realized, hey, we're getting bombarded with orders and API calls, and we need something that has bigger throughput. We need something that has better execution. We need something that has a more standardized data output, fixed connectivity, and so on and so on. And on the security side, we also very early on realized that, hey, we can't just, you know, hold our entire cold storage on our own. So we were the first exchange to do hot cold segregation. We were the first exchange to implement and use multi-sig and so on. So it's always kind of, you take it one step at a time and really listen to what the requirements are in terms of yourself as a business and of your customer base. So we saw, for example, in the past, a lot of exchanges that came in and were super early in offering institutional type of solutions. But if there was no institutional demand and no one to actually use those services, it's all in vain and just like throwing money away. And as you know, this industry is very cyclical. So there are good times and there are bad times. And you just need to be very mindful of how you allocate resources and how you run your business in order to make it in the long run.
Yeah, and you know, something I wanted to ask you about, because getting started when y'all did, you know, 2017 wasn't your first market cycle. You've seen several. 2013 wasn't your first market cycle. Y'all got the full double bubble, if you will, between, you know, 2012 through the end of 2013 top. What was it like in terms of the push, I guess, towards the exchange and the business that came to you and the support burden? Like, what was it like in terms of having to grow into the first couple of cycles that you had as a business versus what you experienced in 2017-18 and then the deflation of that in 2018?
In terms of what's actually going on, it's always the same thing. So all of a sudden, you get a huge influx of account opening. The higher the price, the more accounts are being opened, the more accounts want to get verified. Of course, if they don't get verified the next minute they open the account, they open a support ticket, and one day they open a second support ticket. And if you multiply that by hundreds of thousands of people, you just get, you know, an overwhelming avalanche of just all the customers rushing to the entrance. And of course, there's not a single business that I'm aware of that can actually handle that scale. And running operations for a crypto exchange are a challenge in itself, because you have to scale up in orders of magnitude in the scope of, let's say, a couple of weeks, and then also manage that cool-off period that always happens. And you can always prepare. You can always say, you know, we're going to be ready for the next wave when it comes. But in my experience, and I witnessed something like two or three by now, so you probably recall the first run to $30, even before it went to 1200. I mean, it's always the same, and you're never prepared, simply because you always prepare with the experience you have from before. So let's say you say, okay, we expect to have a quarter of a million customers. But what will you do if you all of a sudden get 2.5 million customers? You know, that's just like this level up that you cannot prepare for.
What percentage of people do you think that get involved during those spikes? Do you keep track of whether those are the same users coming back another time, or is it almost always brand new people, brand new accounts?
It's a mix. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of people go in because they want to speculate on the price. I'm under no illusion that every single person opening an account wants to, you know, participate in the future of financial technology. They just want to make some money. And some trade, some give up, but some stick it out. And by the next cycle, they're veterans. And if you follow crypto Twitter, you see the exact same story. You know, people who came in 2013, they probably got, you know, burned by 2017. They were really good traders, and they could really take the full advantage of the price move. But in terms of just retail investors, it's a mix of everything. So I wouldn't say that a particular group would prevail.
In terms of the exchange, and we'll kind of wrap up the exchange side of things here, because you have a lot to share from a trading perspective. What do y'all look at in terms of what you think customers will want or need next? We always seem to see this rush of like stuff exchanges are fighting over in terms of what to do next. And y'all seem like you've kind of approached things differently thus far. So I'm curious what you think is going to lead to successful exchange experiences in the future. What kind of features, I guess, y'all are working on and thinking of in terms of what that will include?
So it's a two-pronged approach. If you think about mainstream adoption, you have the retail side of the business. And when I say retail, you literally have to think about, you know, your parents, my parents. So people who don't want to look at charts or have very sophisticated trading tools at their disposal, God forbid you give them leverage. They just want a simple, you know, mobile app or some easy way to buy some Bitcoin or crypto and just, you know, enjoy the ride. On the other hand, you have the institutional side of the business, which is growing gradually. I wouldn't say it's growing at an exponential pace, but that's just because the institutions work and follow different logic than retail investors. So they're more concerned about security, custody, connectivity, execution, technology. And in order to serve that specific segment, you need to have infrastructure in place. You need to have licenses. You need to have policies and procedures, and it requires a whole different mindset and approach. And our approach is that both segments of customers need to coexist in order to bring cryptocurrency markets and cryptocurrency trading to the next level. And that's kind of driving our decisions when it comes to what and how do we approach and address one side of the business and one type of customer versus the more professional ones.
Cool. And I did have one other thing to ask, because being in charge of business development, and we talked about not having stable coins because y'all are pretty much fully integrated with fiat currencies. You've had to manage those banking relationships for years. You've never seemed to had any issues with managing banking relationships in a world where it seems, you know, not just Bitfinex, but lots of exchanges have really struggled on the banking front. So how have you been able to do what you've done in terms of seeming like everything is relatively stable in terms of helping people, you know, integrate fiat and cryptocurrencies and not freak everybody out on what the banking side of things?
Oh, we have banking issues as well. But I think we did make a couple of decisions really early on that paid good dividends over the years. And one of them was to start doing AML and KYC. I think we were the first exchange to actually start to enforce that for any account that wanted to be trading and transacting actively. Of course, at the time, we were very unpopular, but at the same time, that enabled us to always have bank accounts. And if you have bank accounts, people can actually, you know, invest or cash out their profits. And over the years, instead of having our banking relationships just cut down, we were actually able to expand them. But we also have had our fair share of, you know, challenges over the years. So one of the most fun ones was in 2013. You remember the Cyprus haircut of all the banks. So Bitstamp had a bank account in one of those banks. And as luck had it, our bank account got closed about a month before they got bail-in. And just imagine what kind of drama would there be if we would be participating in that and actually be losing customer money. I mean, that was a pretty you know, lucky one. But you know, there's a lot of stories, but not every single one of them comes out into the public spotlight.
Yeah. And I guess a lot of that, too, is y'all have a lot of overlap, I assume, like where you're working with a lot of different banks to try to minimize your individual risks.
Oh, of course. We're very mindful of counterparty and credit risk. Once you operate on a certain level, you need to have your risk dispersed, because if you just rely on one banking relationship, you're too dependent and your business is not really that robust. I think that's one of the reasons why stable coins became so successful over the years, partially because of arbitrage, partially because some of the exchanges didn't have such stable banking rails as Bitstamp did.
Yeah, I know it's been a challenge, and I've not been as exposed to a lot of the earlier challenges versus the ones that we've seen since this latest cycle. But y'all have certainly been through the paces, and I appreciate you sharing some of that story. But I want to dig into, you know, Miha the Trader now, because this is actually how I've talked to you the most over the past year. And you seem to always be trading random futures markets, whether it's corn or lately lean hogs and other stuff. So why don't you dig into why you got into the markets that you are trading today? Or is this just the flavor of the month?
It's hard to say. I started with Forex, you know, the standard euro dollar on a Cyprus brokerage, you know, 1,000x with a micro account. Mm-hmm. And you can just imagine that.
Blow that up a few of them.
Yeah, well, you know, I blew up a couple of times. Of course, if someone asked you, how are you doing? You were like, oh, yeah, I'm doing great. But, you know, you were probably refilling the account like for the third time that week. But anyway, FX was something that I did for a while. It took quite a lot of time to actually start becoming, you know, coming to a point where I was breaking even. And to me, after reaching that point, it was much more easy because I kind of got a hang of what my style is, how I control my emotions. I got some more discipline in me. And also I realized that maybe I should be looking beyond just FX and crypto and maybe look at other stuff where maybe I would get a better feel for the market. And that's how I kind of ended up trading a futures market.
Were you primarily day trading at the time, or are you participating in longer swing trades, or what kind of style did you fall into?
I had no idea what I was doing at first. You know, like people say they're trading, all of a sudden everything goes against you and you become an investor or some nonsense like that. But to describe my style today, I wouldn't necessarily say that I'm a day trader. Oh, very rarely do I day trade, maybe only in high volatility events. I would probably call myself a swing trader, if anything else.
Okay, so you're taking part in positions that could last several days or even several weeks sometimes.
Exactly.
Okay. And then in terms of like things that you're looking at in, let's say in a futures market, and we can use lean hogs as our example, because that's a fun one to me that we've been talking about recently, because it's been pretty volatile over the past, over 2019. I guess it's related to some fundamental stuff too, with trade stuff with China. What are you paying attention to when you're watching these charts? Are you a pattern trader, or are you following trends, or what's kind of your go-to stuff?
I would say it's a mix of everything. So for example, lean hogs, I was trading it a little last year, but not much was going on. So I kind of just let it. And then I don't know why, I just kind of typed in the symbol and I opened up this chart and I was like, you know, wow, this is like Bitcoin in 2017. You know, it's like it had that nice bubbly kind of pattern. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to short this.
That was this year?
Yeah, that was this year. So this year I was shorting lean hogs quite heavily. Sometimes I got stopped out, all in all, it was a good trade and still is, I would say.
Yeah, for anyone listening, you can go to HE1 on TradingView. That's the Lean Hogs Futures. And the volatility, you wouldn't expect it, but the low of the year is around $52 and the high of the year is around $92. And this is for something that, you know, people know pretty well what this type of thing costs. So that's an enormous amount of volatility for that market. And yeah, I got to tell you, I almost told you this ahead of time, but I had to save it. I think the top is probably in on hogs, because my dad, it's a holiday here in the U.S. and we're going to grill out tonight. And he was like, hey, you know, because of this China stuff, pork's up like 40%. So maybe you want to get chicken. And I was like, okay, Dad, we could cook chicken instead of pork, but it feels toppy to me, you know, the public's talking about it.
Exactly. So when I shorted the heaviest was when I started seeing all these media coverages of, you know, the pork prices are going up. There's a swine fever in Africa, or, you know, shortage in China or something like that. And when I started trading, I would usually be the guy who would be buying such news. Now I'm the guy who's selling such news.
Yeah. Well, when you are looking at this, I mean, I just see a gigantic head and shoulders potentially now, but certainly a lower high. And I'm with you on this. It'd be hard for me to follow and understand the fundamentals, but there's a lot of fundamental stuff at play here that's part of these moves. So how, if you're not paying attention to the fundamentals, which you said you don't, how do you account for them in your trading, especially in markets that have closing times and, you know, you can get limit gapped up or down?
Oh, it happened to me a couple of times on lean hogs this year. And this is actually the challenge that crypto trading doesn't know. You know, in a 24/7 market, you can always get in and you can always get out. Not mm-hmm. necessarily at the best price, but you can at least cut your losses. With traditional markets, like you said, it's just like a gap up. And if you're short, you're in trouble. And now imagine if that were like to continue for a couple of days. And that's what really kind of got me into managing my risk more carefully. But in terms of what I'm looking for when I'm trading, my view is that I'm not a fundamentals guy. And even if I would, someone always has more information than me. Someone will always be faster than me. And someone is always more informed than me. So even if I know all the fundamentals, that still doesn't necessarily mean that my view on the market is going to be correct. But I did find an interesting sentence, like in Market Wizards. I'm rereading that book, by the way. And that price action is always preceding fundamentals. And I would tend to agree with that. I just look at price action, volume profile, and just kind of try to listen to my gut feel whether is the market behaving like it's supposed to be behaving in a situation like this, or am I seeing something else?
When you're addressing these markets, it sounds like you are using leverage on the platforms that you're trading them on.
Yes, of course.
So when you do so, I guess what are some, we've both seen a lot of people trading cryptocurrency with leverage. What are some of the things you've learned trading traditional markets with leverage and sometimes significant leverage that you think would be helpful for someone that, whether they're trading traditional markets or if they're, you know, trading Bitcoin or whatever else on leverage?
I don't know. I made so many mistakes, I don't know where to begin. I think being mindful of the size of your position is key. So what I did in the early days, I was, for example, I always wanted to get in at the bottom or at the top with a huge position, you know, with the view that I'm going to maximize my profits. Mm-hmm. Now I actually do exactly the opposite. So for example, I would try and probe the market with a small position. If it goes into, you know, if it behaves and go into my direction, I just follow the trend and scale up, or I just cut my losses very fast because otherwise, you know, it just losses just become exponential.
Yeah. So if you're going in, let's say you're calling the top on lean hogs at $90, then you'll probe the market. Maybe you'll take your, what are you going in tranches, maybe 10, 15% initially to of what your potential position size would be to make that probe, or what is it even smaller than that?
I would always try, let's say if we think of futures trading, I always take a probe with one lot and okay. Just like take it as my benchmark and also always set my stop loss and then just see what happens. Over the years, I've did every single mistake I could. So, you know, I would put in a stop loss or even trade without a stop loss. And when the price didn't go my way, I would just like cancel it out or whatever. Now I just like wait for it to hit. If it gets hit, no problem. You know, I'm just going to wait a little bit and retry. And, you know, sure, maybe I won't get my entry the first time. Maybe I'm only going to get it like the third time. But at least I will not be carrying risk when the market is going against me. So, you know, I would short once, look how the market behaves. And if it's starting to kind of just like sell off, I would sell some more. And, you know, when capitulation happens, you just go kind of all in almost.
How do you look at it on the other side when you're looking at profit taking? Do you see similar styles of, you mentioned capitulation in terms of your entering the position, but when you're exiting positions too, do you try to get out in front of it and, you know, predict the end of the trend when it's gone your way, or are you scaling out as well?
I usually scale in when I enter the position, but I usually exit at all at the same level. Only rarely would I scale out. If you think about futures markets, those are very liquid markets. So and I don't trade at the size where I would need to be that mindful of what price do I get and which levels I get out. Sometimes I would maybe sell some. Or take some profits along the way. But to me, it's more important that the trade overall works out and that I followed my system. And I kind of realized that if I'm not that greedy, I actually make a better trade in the end than if I would, like, you know, want to catch every single tick.
And how do you keep track of all these markets? Like, there's, I don't even know how many futures markets you can get just if you're looking at CME, for instance, but there's a lot of stuff to keep track of. So are you using screeners to sift through what you want to pay attention to, or what do you do there?
So I use a mix, but often it's just like randomly going through the markets that I'm used to trading. And if you see something, let's say in hogs, there's a good chance that there's a correlation with soybeans or corn or wheat or something else. Or if there's a move, let's say in the S&P, you look at the VIX, you look at a couple of, or gold, for example. So I structure my ideas around correlations and inverse correlations, but I'm not obsessed with trying to take advantage of every single thing there is. Often I would just like pick a few and only focus on the ones where I think there's going to be the biggest opportunity, and just ignoring everything else, because I'm not a machine. I'm a human being, and I can only trade so much myself.
Are you trying to counterbalance your exposure sometimes when you're looking at traditional markets relative to Bitcoin, or are you trading these just because they're fun? I guess part of that question would be, are you trading Bitcoin too, or are you trading these markets because you're trying to stay away from trading Bitcoin because your career is there?
So yeah, I would say it's more the latter. I have a very kind of bullish long-term view on Bitcoin, and I can't actually get myself to be trading what I'm actually involved in on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, trading traditional markets is, I think, even more challenging than Bitcoin. So I just try to kind of improve my skills as a trader, and that doesn't necessarily mean that I have to trade Bitcoin. I mean, I deal with Bitcoin every single day for the past 6 or 7 years. So, it's a good counterbalance to be maybe also exposed to oil a bit and S&P, and kind of have also some understanding of what's going on in the world beyond just Bitcoin and crypto.
I know you said you're not a fundamentals person, but I'm curious if you have thoughts on the global market and some of the stuff we're seeing going on and the resurgence we've seen with crypto in 2019, especially, I guess, perhaps with Chinese currency and maybe a little bit with the stock market, and then relative to this resurgence we've seen.
In terms of the stock market, I'm not long any equities, so I stay away from them. In terms of FX, it's really kind of, the whole thing's a mess, right? There's Europe with its challenges, and the US, so I can't really get myself to be taking a big view on anything, since I have the impression that the whole thing can just blow up in either direction. And I just don't know what's gonna happen when I look at the screen. So that's why I prefer to trade something like commodities, where they're, regardless of the political or, all the different stuff that's going on in the world, people will always need oil and meat and wheat and the fundamental stuff that you need to survive for an economy and society to actually exist. So I just focus on those for the time being. And also, they offer more leverage.
Mm. Are you ever looking at things like bond yields or that kind of instrument?
I only looked at the charts every now and then, but the yields are, I think they're on the decline for the last 30 years anyway. So as a macro trend, I think it's too capital intense for me. I like to maximize what I have when it comes to investing and trading.
And then I guess, how do you approach your day when you're looking at a market? I mean, you've got a full-time job a busy one as an executive at an exchange. And then also you might want to pay attention to the market open if you're in a trade on a commodity. So how much attention are you giving to the market open and then managing that trade throughout the day while you're doing other stuff? I think the average listener is going to be curious about that too, because most people listening to this do have a full-time job.
So this challenge helped me a lot when coming up with discipline, and because I cannot look at the chart when I'm at work. So I just had to force myself in the beginning to really do the analysis and just put in the limit order, you know, the stop loss, the take profit, and just leave it there. And just have to rely on that my system will work out even if I'm not there. I travel a lot, for example, and you know, I can't risk to have a huge position while I'm, you know, somewhere, you know, mid-flight over the Atlantic, you know, exactly. It's dangerous. So that's why I had to really get myself to use the time to the max when I actually have time to look at the charts and identify liquidity, you know, blocks of liquidity, potential turning points, you know, support resistance lines, and then just put the trades in and have the discipline and the patience to wait it out. And it worked well. So definitely one of the worst things that I used to do was overtrade and look at the charts too much, or you enter a trade and then you kind of forget why that trade is there. No, you take a view on the weekly and the daily charts, and then all of a sudden you're like nervously refreshing the 4 hour or the 1 hour chart. And, you know, it never works out. So I just kind of stick to my system and try to be as disciplined as possible.
How hard has it been to tackle your own psychology and manage your mind, if you will, and let your system do the thinking for you?
Still is.
Still your greatest challenge?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
I can agree with that. And yeah, for me, I mean, I'm jealous sometimes when people say they don't pay attention to the fundamentals, because I really like to be a blended trader myself and keep a bias based on my fundamentals and then look for the trade that agrees with my bias on the technical side of things. And sometimes that makes it even harder to manage when the trade goes against you. For instance, for me, I mean, like the degree of the move back up for the S&P just baffled me. The fact that we were able to make all-time highs. Like, I could not get my head around the fact that that was possible after what we saw in December and the state of the economy in my mind. So like being able to manage your psychology, I feel like, is so important. So yeah, I'm jealous if you're able to truly ignore the fundamental side of things.
I mean, the market's going to do what the market's going to do. And what I think, or what, you know, what the media says, or what the supposedly kind of fundamental implications would be, is completely irrelevant. You know, just think of, for example, you probably recall the Euro Swiss or Euro pound sterling, you know, when Brexit happened.
Oh yeah.
So that was a contrarian trade, for example, that not many people took, but the ones who did, and it just ignored the general kind of attitude of, you know, everything's fine, everything's okay, made a killing. And when it comes to fundamentals, I often consider myself to be a bit of a contrarian. So, you know, by the time it's in the news, it's probably already too late.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I guess, and then let's finish with your outlook on crypto. We're obviously pretty extended, and you said you're bullish on crypto long term. Is there anything that you do to manage that within these like hyper trends that we see? Like if we're like now where we're up over 100% year to date, or do you personally just kind of let it roll over time?
I when it comes to Bitcoin, for the last couple of weeks, I have absolutely no idea what's going on. I mean, this is just beyond what I imagined. So when we broke 6, I was like, okay, you know, this was, I kind of anticipated this, something like this would happen, but that we would be almost trading at 9K in such a short period of time, you know, it caught me by surprise. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I don't trade Bitcoin or crypto, is because, you know, you said it's overextended, but I would not dare to short Bitcoin, even if I thought it's overextended. I would probably wait for the market to signal some sort of weakness before I would actually put on any trades. Yeah, I think that's about it.
Yeah, I agree with you in terms of the degree of the move. Like I was similar, and I thought that maybe we'd get a short squeeze. The sentiment was really ripe to have a short squeeze leading into 6,400. You know, it was the most obvious short or whatever, except for like 60% of people were short and all these other things that made me think that we might spike through 6,400. But I thought it would be a short squeeze and not just like a rip straight through. And what was fascinating to me is, you know, a lot of people that have been in the market a long time were expecting, hey, we're going to range for a while. Like this market needs time to collect itself and accumulate and all that kind of stuff. And we're really just not doing anything like that. If we're going to range, then we're now setting the tone that we're going to range well above the bottom. So it's been super interesting to me, and a lot to learn from, because it's not something I would have been able to predict. And I don't think very many people would have been able to predict this degree of move year to date in 2019, for sure.
Yeah, likewise. I was kind of looking at 6K to be that major resistance, right? Because mm-hmm. last year, the price just kept bouncing off 6K. You know, we went from 6 to 12, from 6 to 10, from 6 to 8. And all of a sudden, we just, you know, we broke down. And even that was after some like really, really kind of tight compression. But now we just shot through and just like we're heading straight for the moon. So I have no idea. Even the range that's being set right now, I would probably wait to see what levels are being established.
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned on Twitter yesterday that we just hit, I think, our fourth week in a row where we closed outside the top Bollinger Band, which is a multi-standard deviation move. So it's like, it's just crazy. But the fact that we've been so trending when... I feel like so many of us expected for Bitcoin to be range bound has been wild. And I'll finish our interview here, which is, when something like this happens and you're at an exchange, like, does this change your thinking in terms of how you guys are planning for a potential, you know, new bull market if you start seeing stuff that's sooner than you might have expected? Or do you pretty much stay the course?
I wouldn't say that we change our approach, but you definitely start paying more attention. So often people would look at the chart and want to understand what's going to happen in terms of price. Well, we look at the chart and kind of try to understand like what to expect in terms of like the low that we get. And it's more an art than a science, you know. It's mm-hmm. very unpredictable. But we kind of, over the years, we came up with a system where we can actually just kind of gradually scale up or scale down depending on what the actual day-to-day requirements are. But, you know, if you enter in a scenario where the price action just becomes parabolic, then there's no time to second guess. Then, you know, you need to do something and you need to do it immediately.
Yeah. Have y'all, is this something that you can share, whether you've seen a resurgence of accounts to go along with what's been a really high volume trading area?
I cannot go into details, but all I can say is that operations and loads and new accounts always kind of follow the same trajectory as the as the price. Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, I guess why don't you leave us with what's your last little bit of advice that you'd like for a burgeoning trader or someone interested in the crypto space? What would you like to leave them with?
That's a good question. I was hoping you would give me a heads up so I would kind of give it a thought. But I don't know. I think the things that I'm still struggling myself, I would say control your emotions. And if you don't feel good about something, or if you don't feel sure about something, sleep it over and look at it, you know, the other day, tomorrow, with a, you know, a fresh mind and a kind of different perspective. But never go, you know, FUD or FOMO. That's the most dangerous things.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, and I appreciate you sharing it. Hey, Miha, where should people go? I mean, they can go to bitstamp.net, but is there anywhere for you personally that people should pay attention to what you have going on?
So I have a Twitter profile, but I'm just getting started. So it's Miha _GRCAR, where hopefully I'm going to be more active than I used to be.
That sounds good. It says you haven't tweeted yet, so we're looking forward to that first tweet. We've got to get this account that's its initial pump. We'll put the link in the show notes, and we appreciate you sharing your knowledge and your story too. I mean, been around a long time, and I always love learning from somebody, both in terms of the crypto market and also traditional market. So thanks for sharing with us today.
Thank you. It's been fun. Monuments crumble in the blink of an eye. The easy river has just run dry. In a house of cards, I feel the breeze wound so tight.